Hey, welcome to an episode of Crippled by Culture, where we talk about everything in life and related to the disabled and chronically ill community. My name is Sean Gold, and I am an author, advocate, and nonverbal public speaker for the disabled community. To provide a quick visual description for accessibility, I am a Black man with a white tracheostomy breathing tube in my neck. I am wearing a black shirt. The person off camera who you hear speaking for me. This video is of a Zoom call with me and the person talking for me off camera, and my guest is in the other box next to it. Today, I would like to thank Terry Briscoe for being my voice in this episode. In this episode, we are talking about the intersections of disability, sexuality, mental health, community, and healing.
Before we get any further into the interview, I want to give a shout out to our partnering nonprofit festival for this series, Festability. As the media director, I help organize a wonderful event in St. Louis at the Missouri History Museum. We have so many activities and vendors set up all over with an amazing headliner for our main stage each year. It is the best event in St. Louis to celebrate your disability unapologetically while celebrating the Americans with Disabilities Act. Make sure you come out if you're nearby. Check out the link in the description to learn more. Thank you, Festability, for sponsoring the series. Now, back to the show.
Now let's get to today's amazing guest. Jebin is a teacher, editor, and queer academic. He grew up in a conservative society and suffered from internalized homophobia as a child. Later on in college, he was diagnosed with depression. Jebin is on a path to healing now. His quest is to find out how we can all heal, particularly in the LGBT community, and live life to the fullest. Jebin, thank you for being here today. How are you doing? Would you mind giving us a visual description of yourself, please?
Thank you so much. I'm doing really well, thank you. So I'm Indian, I'm a brown man. I have a big beard, black hair, black mustache, and I'm wearing a black t-shirt. And I'm really happy to be here. It's my honor, thank you.
I appreciate that. First, do you identify with having a disability or chronic illness? If so, do you mind sharing what disabilities or chronic illnesses you have?
So yes, I live with depression, which keeps changing shape and form, and often it's invisible, and it manifests in different ways in different times, and it wasn't diagnosed until I was in college. So growing up, it was a certain form of melancholia, which I never really understood. And I'm still on the path to understanding it. I also have generalized anxiety disorder. Again, both anxiety and clinical depression, the way they manifest keep changing. And it is something that I have to learn to live with. And I'm still in the process of identifying, understanding, and learning how to better live with it without losing functionality.
Okay. How does your disability affect your everyday life?
My disability affects my everyday life in the sense that it has a dampening effect on my confidence. Very often people don't believe it when I say I'm not feeling well. And there are days, there have been incidents where people did not believe that I had a disability, that I was just making it up. And living in a place where mental health issues have not gained ground, people think that it's something that's not really serious. I have been told that my disability and my struggle, that they are not real. I have been told that it's all in my head. And the most well-meaning people can actually say ridiculous things like, maybe you should drink more milk and eat more vegetables. And there are episodes where my disability might manifest with something as simple as sleep. Sleep in the sense that it could take, that I might sleep for 18 hours in one go and wake up with a terrible back pain and headache. And these are things that cannot be really cited at work or in my research center where I was doing my PhD. So I would often have to come up with ways to describe it. I often wished that it was something that could be measured like temperature with a thermometer, because people could not really understand my pain. And there is no clear language to express the horrific levels of discomfort and despair I might go through. I would not be able to get out of bed at all. It would feel as if my body were made of lead, and it would be extremely physical, but that's what I have not been able to communicate. And there is always this fear that I'm not really believed. And there is always this fear that if I told people about my disability, I would be judged and I would be seen as less competent, and that I might be seen as a liability at work more than an asset. And this haunts me.
Can you tell me how old you were when you got diagnosed? And do you feel like there are other things going on that you feel are undiagnosed?
So when I was diagnosed properly in a hospital with depression, I think I was 22 years old. The first time I had a major episode, like a really major episode of depression, was when I was 20. And I was at home, I was hospitalized. And finally, even though I was in a hospital, in and out of hospitals, nobody really thought about giving me a psychiatric test. I took an MRI, my brain was scanned, my body was scanned, and all possible X-ray and whatever, everything was taken, but nobody really thought of paying attention to my mind. And that's why it took 2 more years for me to finally go to a psychiatrist and then be identified for what it was. And so I was 22 when I was diagnosed with clinical depression and generalized anxiety disorder. And as for whether there are as yet undiagnosed things, I'm not sure. I often think that there is an element that is missing, that my diagnosis has not been holistic. There are many things which make it very tricky. So when people think of depression, people generally become very surprised when I tell them I have depression or things like that, because I'm basically a very happy person. And I'm happy and bright. And when things are going well, it's very difficult for even me to conceive of myself as somebody who lives with depression. And my depression is also extremely physical. Sometimes it's much more physical than it is mental. I would not be really feeling much emotional distress, but my physical distress would be more. I would get rashes on my body, and I wouldn't be able to get out of bed at all. And when my emotions are comparatively better, even I question my diagnosis at that point. I often ask people, like, are you sure this is what it is? Do I really have depression, or is this something else? Could there be some kind of nutrition deficiency in me, or things like that? And there are times when there is a lot of emotional distress, and there are times when it's just sleep, and there are times where I may have a bad week and then feel as if a year had passed, and I would have forgotten a lot of things that had just happened. And I would feel as if so many things that had happened way long back, years ago, had happened just some time ago. There is a lot of cognitive dissonance that happens in my brain. And I feel like with psychiatry and with mental health issues, we haven't learned enough. And we are only at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to diagnosing people with mental health issues. And I feel like it's not just me, but so many more people. We in general haven't understood depression and mental health issues in their entirety.
Now, those are some great points. For those who may not know or understand, can you explain how depression can turn into a diagnosis?
I would not have even thought about going to a hospital unless it had, it was that bad. I often hear people talking about depression and say very lightly. And sometimes there are people who may go through a very hard time and they may question, am I going through depression? Is this depression? It's a bit complex. I would urge anybody undergoing any kind of distress mentally to just seek help from a professional mental health practitioner, psychologist, psychiatrist, or counselor, just to make sure we identify what it is. So some of the hallmarks of depression include not really knowing what's wrong or what we're sad about. So for me, the most jarring thing that happened when I got my first major episode was the fact that I was in a very happy place in life. I was in the final year of my undergraduate education in college. I was in theater. We had just had a major theater event in college and I had done reasonably well and I was proud of myself. And I was very happy. I was looking forward to what was next. I was planning my postgraduate education. And I was really happy with my friendships. And I was in the best place in my life. And I remember waking up one morning and feeling horrible. And I remember breaking into tears. I'm not somebody who cries easily. Like tears don't come, for me. I mean, even if I'm very sad, I don't cry. Not because I'm some kind of a strong person or anything. That's just how my body works. I would sooner choke and not be able to talk than cry. But that day I cried a lot and I felt like I was no longer in control of my emotions. I was no longer in control of myself. And I clearly remember calling an aunt of mine that I'm very close to. She's a counselor and telling her, I'm feeling a sadness that is not mine because there is nothing to make me sad at the moment. And that is how the journey began for me because I knew it wasn't something, nothing sad had happened. Now, I believe that things would have been a lot more complicated if something sad had happened. Then I would not have realized that there was something else going on. Depression can look like sadness, but it's much more different than sadness. Sadness, when we're sad with something, we know what's causing it. With depression, we cannot know what's causing it. It could be a traumatic incident that happened in the past. It could be physiological distress. Something wrong with the body, maybe some hormone imbalance or something, which the brain is processing in this fashion. It could be purely physiological. It could be part physiological and part trauma-induced and part induced by circumstances. If it's purely circumstantial, it goes away after a point. So what experts say is that with depression, the dip that people face when they have something horrible happening to them or anything at all of that sort, any dip in a person's mood, it sticks, it stays. They don't come out of it, they stay there. And if it lasts for more than a few weeks or more than a month, then it signals, it shows that they probably have major depressive disorder. And again, there is hardly enough knowledge. So many people find depression in different ways. And there is high functioning depression where people are able to function so well. Like when I have a bad episode, I cannot function. Thankfully, it doesn't happen very often. I would have to take a break. But there are people who continue to work and who excel in everything with this heavy weight in their heart. They can function a lot, but they still do have depression, which is why we have not understood enough and we cannot diagnose ourselves. It's really tricky to diagnose ourselves because we're really harsh with ourselves. And people must understand that depression is just like blood pressure or diabetes. It cannot simply be prayed away or meditated away. Yes, those practices will definitely help. Self-love helps, being conscious helps, having a good diet helps, but it may not be enough. So it is absolutely necessary for anybody who has even an inkling of an idea that they might be going through something that is larger than mere sadness or some emotional distress to actually go visit a psychiatrist or any medical health practitioner.
Thanks for that. Did you have to go through your own internalized ableism? How has that journey been like towards inner acceptance for you?
It took a long time. At first, I told myself, okay, let's take some medication. This is going to be fixed. This is something that can be completely fixed. And I kept waiting to find some kind of sunshine or really good health, and I kept trying harder and harder. I was trying to go back to that place I was in before my first major depressive episode. But again, as I said, even as a child, I had terrible bouts of melancholia. So I was trying to go to that up place, that happy place. And every time I slipped, I was really harsh on myself because I thought I hadn't fixed it. I was seeking a permanent solution, whereas I did not see it as a condition that might stay with me. That took a long time. Now I am kinder to myself. Now that I have accepted that I have a condition that may change or may not change. Either way, I'm going to be happy and do my best. So that's the mentality I have right now. As for internalized ableism, it's a very big deal where I come from. It's something that... So when I think about my sexuality and I was in the closet, I feel like that I was in the closet for two things. One was my sexuality and another was my depression, because nobody talks about things like these. And if I thought if I told people I have depression, I have neurosis of a certain kind, I thought they might think I was crazy or just mentally unsound to the point where people couldn't really hang out with me. This fear was there, especially since I was not educated enough in this matter, and people around me were not educated enough either. It took a lot of communication with my friends, a lot of communication with my friends and my family for me to really open up about my struggles. And one of the really heartwarming things I found was that it was not just me who was going through things like this. When I came out with my disability and my depression, I found that a lot of other people were suffering from similar problems. I found friends suffering from panic attacks and not knowing what it was. And they were able to seek help and are leading better lives now, thanks to us having that simple conversation. Ableism is still entrenched in India. And in my place, for example, one of the main things that would stop my peers from coming out with their disability, invisible disability, would be marriage. So we still practice arranged marriage, and a boy or a girl is expected to be perfect for the marriage market. And so even parents do not talk about it. So even now if I go to visit my psychiatrist and my aunt calls and asks my mother, what's the issue? It would be much easier for my mother to say, oh, he's gone somewhere, I don't know, or he's gone to a friend's place, rather than say he's gone to the psychiatrist, because that is something the adults fear. They fear that we would not find suitable matches for, that they feel they wouldn't be able to find suitable matches for their children if these disabilities were known. And so be it epilepsy or depression or schizophrenia, anything that can be controlled with medication, people are educated enough to send their children to the right doctor and get the right medication, but they are really reluctant to share it because it would affect their marital prospects. And as for internalized ableism, it took me a very long time for me to be really kind to myself and say, hey, you're okay. Yes, you have a disability, own it and learn how to befriend it. And it took me a long time to not see it as a liability, but just another thing, just another beautiful aspect of life. And for me, that took time and a lot of reading and a lot of talking to really nice people. And it can be very tough. And it keeps changing, as I said. I mean, now I have medication, but there are certain side effects of some of the medication I take. And one of the terrible side effects is that, so antidepressants really reduce a person's libido or sexual drive. And so that's another block. And I'm young and dating, and it can be very tough to find a date, and then to it again really has a bad effect on your confidence if you're not able to perform well sexually. And again, that's something that's really not talked about in India. That's another taboo, but it's very, very real. Antidepressants can reduce your sexual drive, but I cannot afford to not take it simply to have a better date because I know better. And so I have to take the medication. And then there is going to be an inevitable conversation with a date who might take it well if they're educated. By educated, I mean openness. Not just going to school or college, but being open to difference and being open to hearing and already having some kind of knowledge about mental health issues. But I can't help feeling that I might scare them away or disappoint them. And if they do not come for a second date, I can't help but wonder, okay, is it because of that? And I still hope for better medication. I still hope for things to change. But the perspective is a bit different for me. I no longer wish to run away from anything, and I'm really happy with myself. And if somebody does not come for a second date, I no longer really think, oh, is it this or is it? It could be anything. And I've learned to be happy with myself, but the struggle is real. And these conversations that we have to have regarding mental health, they don't always go very well. As I've said, people have suggested things like drinking milk and eating more vegetables and stopping my medication, which has come up so many times. People say, oh, you're such a happy boy. Why would something, come on, just stop that medication. We can work it out. I've had people say that, and I know better. So I tell them, no, it's not as simple as that. You're seeing me right now because I have been doing a lot to heal myself, and medication is a part of it. So there are tough conversations which we have to have. And there are incidents which really might break our confidence and might make us feel bad. But eventually, all these things help us. They strengthen us. But this internalized ableism, this fear towards having a disability, It's really quite a struggle to become mature enough and kind enough to ourselves to accept ourselves as who we are, because the world is not always very accepting, and very often people can give a lot of bad advice, like, come on, just throw away that medication, don't take it, don't go to the doctor anymore, you're all right, you're okay, and things like that. There are a lot of challenges. But we as people with disabilities and people marginalized in so many ways with disability, sexuality, people who are often not represented well enough, must stand up for ourselves and make sure we represent ourselves right and stand up for what we know is correct and educate people when they do not know, because they don't have the experience we do. They do not know. They cannot know. And if they're willing to understand, we must help them understand. And if they do not want to hear, well, that's not our fault. All we can do is try. And the struggle is hard, but it's worth it.
Definitely, definitely. Do you think having your sexuality highlighted the internal ableism even more?
Yes. I mean, so initially I thought of my sexuality as a disability too. Again, that's how it is seen. It is so in the Indian subcontinent. So I've been working with literature on issues pertaining to the LGBTQ community. And even in our literature, we can easily find that being gay is often seen to be a curse or a disease, or a mistake that the parents did, or a mistake that somebody else did. It is not, we hardly have a non-pathological language for sexuality. When I came out to my parents, I remember my mother telling me in a very, she was trying to be as positive as possible, and she had only good intentions at heart. And what she said was, it's okay, we all have some kind of a disability. Everybody has some kind of a disability, and it's okay. And I wanted to tell her, there's nothing wrong with this. I'm perfectly okay. I mean, so even my sexuality was seen as a disability. And for a very long time, I saw it as a disability. I saw it as something that was going to take away my quality of life, something that would not let me have a happy family, any family of my own, and was probably going to get me into a lot of trouble. That's how I saw it. And it took me a very long time. And the title Crippled by Culture is so apt. It took me a very long time to realize that I was not crippled by nature, but crippled by culture.
Exactly.
Yes. So initially I kept wondering what was wrong. I wanted to fix my sexuality. I was so careful with how I moved, how I spoke, with how I sat, with how I walked. And it was a lot of stress. And a lot of stress in the sense my default mode was stress. I was always stressed. I was never free. And it was also around this time that as a child growing up and having all these thoughts, am I gay? Oh my God, how horrible. I hope it's not that, without even knowing what it was. And fearing, so much fear. I was so afraid that I did not even know anything about sexuality. And I only heard from here and there about all these sinister whispers, people talking about men with other men, and It was only through all these sinister whispers that I slowly understood that something was wrong with me, because that's how people were representing it. So that's where it began, that something was wrong. And then I was trying to fix something, that something which was wrong. So the whole this whole process was wrong from the beginning. There was nothing really wrong with me, yet I went in search of something that was definitely wrong with me. And I was doing my best to fix it. When nothing was actually wrong with me, I was trying to fix something that I was sure was wrong with me by doing things like walking straighter, exercising, playing more football, which I really loved. And somehow not believing that I was that way. And so when I started getting real challenges with my mental health, it was all clubbed together. It was one really entangled mass in my head. And I believe some of my friends who were really trying to help me out also thought it could be related to my sexuality. That could be the reason for my depression. It took me a long time to understand that depression is not that simple. It's not like, oh, I'm gay and I can't change it. Okay, I'm depressed. No, it's not that. It's much more complex than that. It could be triggered, but it cannot be created by something as simple as that. And it took me a very long time to separate myself from my depression and not call myself just a depressed man, but somebody who has depression. It took me time to take my identity a little step back from the disability that I was going through. That it was not me in its entirety. I wasn't a ball of depression. I was a person with so many sides, and I still am. I'm a happy person. There are so many sides to me. Sexuality is one part of it, and my disability is another part of it. But during the period when my sexuality and my depression were all entangled in my brain, I thought it was my sexuality that was causing the depression. I thought it was my punishment. And I was probably right, because I punished myself. I kept thinking horrible things, and I kept feeling a guilt that should never have been mine in the first place. But the culture that I was in, even now people are trying to fix me. People who think they know better, who really care for me, still pray for me to get better. And by better, I mean somehow turn heterosexual. I have told them time and time again that I'm that I'm perfect just the way I am, even with my depression, because there are so many things that we can all do. And because of my depression, I understand people so much more. I have so much more empathy and so much more kindness, because I know that a person could look very happy on the outside and everybody seeing them might think, okay, he has his stuff together, but his reality could be something else. All this this empathy, this kindness, the maturity that I have, my depression has played such a big role in it. So now I'm thankful for my sexuality, for my depression, and I see them as aspects of myself, but not completely me in my entirety. But you are right, it did my depression and my sexuality initially did have something of a vicious cycle kind of relationship. One increased the other increased more guilt here, and things were really messed up, and it was a very, very crippling experience because of culture.
Yes, yes. Thanks for that. That is a very common experience for people who are LGBTQ. Can you tell us, what do you think you've learned that stays with you on a daily basis from the disability community or a specific disabled person?
I have learned to really try to see life through my experiences and through the experiences of my disabled friends. I have quite a few disabled friends, and it is no longer surprising to me that they are some of the best people I've known. They have so much life in them. They have so much joy and such an exuberance of life. And they live life one day at a time. I mean, this is not something that can be generalized. I think maybe it's just my friends. I have friends with disabilities with whom we have great conversations, and we have, and so before I got to know people with disability, with multiple kinds of disabilities, I used to think of people with disabilities with a kind of foreboding, with a kind of pity. Like I would, more than pity, it was a kind of fear. I did not know how to talk to them. I was afraid I might say something wrong. And I felt really bad for them. And it was only after getting to know blind people, people with forms of disability like multiple sclerosis or speech disabilities, people with physical disabilities, people with autoimmune diseases. It was only then that I saw that I should not project my idea onto them, because what they were, it was completely different from anything that I might have imagined. We did not sit talking about our disabilities and moaning and groaning and feeling sad and sorry for ourselves. That's not what it was at all. In fact, after, I have more able-bodied friends who are sorry for themselves and who are not moving much because they are caught in that ball of pity. Because some of us have, a lot of us are struggling with the economic ups and downs and not having enough job opportunities here. And some of my friends are stuck and they resort to drinking and then talking to each other and feeling so sorry for themselves. I must say that this is, again, my personal experience. I cannot generalize this, but I have not experienced this with my disabled friends. They are some of the strongest people I know, and I get so much energy from them. I talk to any one of my disabled friends, and I feel so much better. But this, I think, is because of how they have experienced hardship. And I think the biggest hardship most of them experience is not something that comes from them, but something that comes from outside. One of the things that cripples people the most is the ignorance of other people. People assume so many things about people with disabilities that it is very difficult sometimes for the disabled person to actually get proper representation through to the masses. It is people with disabilities, we are all people, and we all have the same desires and different desires. We are all human, and people with disabilities are in a position to learn a lot, because one of the things that I have learned with my disabilities to not take a single day for granted. If I'm able to get out of bed, then I'm going to be a very happy person. I'm going to be everywhere, because I know that it's a privilege to be able to get out of bed. I know that it's not every day. I know that tomorrow might be different. And with my disabled friends as well, I have learned so much. My disabled friends practice gratitude. That is something I practice well. And we practice gratitude as a form of meditation. It's something we do actively and consciously. There are so many of these practices that we have built, which make us formidably strong human beings. And we are in a kind of mainstream culture where we get a certain kind of representation from certain kind of people. And it has formed a kind of narrative where we believe that this is how the world is. It's only when we see different people, people who are not represented on mainstream media, that we find that life is so different. Life is not at all what they make it out to be in Hollywood and Disney. I mean, a little bit, it could be there. But the, life is not at all limiting. I think we really must meet people with disabilities and differences as much as possible to know that life is actually really dynamic, and happiness does not come from an able body or from materials or from anything on the outside, but only from inside. I have learned a lot, and I'm still learning more from all my friends with disabilities.
Yeah. Okay. When did you realize that you were part of the queer community? And how was the self-acceptance, how has the self-acceptance journey been for you?
So I knew that I was attracted to men very early on. I did not have a moment of epiphany or any kind of bells ringing or that kind of a realization where I was like, oh my God, I'm gay. Other people might have that. I did not. I knew that I was attracted to men when I was a very small child, probably in kindergarten. But only as I grew up, I understood that my attraction was of a certain kind that was not shared by heterosexual boys, that they liked girls the way I liked boys. And so far, it is not problematic. It became problematic only when I was a teenager and they started teaching all these things in Sunday school, and they thought it was a sin. I did not know it was a sin until then. And then I rushed home and read the Bible, and yep, there it was. And then I really struggled with it. I grew up very, very religious. I still am a practicing believer, but I would not call myself religious at all anymore. But I was very religious. It was a very big stumbling block. So my realization was very simple, and very early on, I knew that I was gay. But accepting it was an entirely different story. I prayed and prayed that I would not turn out gay, that it was just some kind of a phase. I did not really have access to the internet and things like that when I was younger. And I did not know the difference between being gay, and I did not really know the difference between sexuality and gender. So I thought I was transgender. And again, I did not have a good representation of of diverse forms of sexuality and gender growing up. So the first time I saw transgender people, it was on a train, and as a child, it was very scary because one of them demanded some money from me, and I was still a very young boy, so I tried to hide away, and I went to the top compartment of the train, not the top compartment, the topmost bunk of the train, and hid there until they had passed by. And then I thought, okay, is that who I'm going to be? So there was a fear. I had internalized transphobia and homophobia as well. I did not have a positive representation of beautiful transgender people, which I have today. I have people from the transgender community and from the gay and lesbian community now, which I did not have back then. So for me, I thought I was going to be transgender and shunned by society, that was the kind of life I was going to have. I thought I was going to be gay and so lose my place in the church. and lose my place in heaven and probably damned for all eternity. It took me a very long time to get my relationship with God straight, my spiritual life straight. And then it took me a very long time to come out to my parents. So there was always this fear that I might not be accepted. And I did not know what form it might take. I knew my parents loved me a lot, but there was a very big fear that things might change and I might have to leave home. So there was a lot of fear which got in the way of me accepting myself completely, because if life was going to be that bad, then I thought I'd better change myself, because why would I want life to be that bad for me? And so I tried my best to change, to pray. And that did no end of harm to my sense of self, because I wasn't seeing myself as a positive thing at all. I was seeing myself as a bundle of wrongs, all things gone wrong. And but slowly, I mean, I came out to one cousin sister, and I would call her on the weekends and tell her what I was going through, one auntie, one friend. And then it eased things a little bit better for me. That was the beginning of me finally accepting myself. Because I knew I wasn't changing, that wasn't helping. And acceptance took a very long time. It should not have to take so long. It should not have to be so difficult for somebody at a very volatile age in their life on earth to go through something like this. This is where we must make sure that our culture does not keep crippling people. Because it was very, very difficult for me to accept myself. So understanding that I was a certain way was very quick. Accepting that might have taken 10 years or something, but it feels like a lifetime, and it should not feel that way.
Definitely, definitely not. How do you feel about the current representation regarding both being queer and disabled?
So being queer and disabled, I think it's, we have a very long way to go. There are queer people with a lot of different kinds of disabilities, and dating itself still, sadly, in India, mostly happens in the shadows. There are very few people that can be found openly on major platforms like Bumble, dating platforms like Bumble. And people who have really accepted their sexuality very often would have accepted their disability as well. And then we can have a conversation and we can really proceed and get to know each other as people. But people who have not embraced their sexuality and people who have not embraced their disability are very often not found openly. They're not open about it. And I believe they have just reasons for it, because families do not accept a lot of people. So among all the gay and lesbian friends that I have, there's only one bisexual friend of mine who is open. His parents know. And one lesbian friend of mine, I think her mother knows, but then she's moved to London. And when we talk about issues such as depression, now I know that a lot of us do have invisible disabilities and also visible disabilities. But even finding somebody who is marginalized in terms of sexuality or gender is not very easy. And in the LGBTQ community, I do not happen to know enough people with different forms of disability. I would like to move from highly visible and highly open platforms like Bumble to more sex-based hookup apps like Grindr, which are also very famous. We can find a lot of different people on Grindr, but Grindr offers a very harsh environment. People who don't look a certain way are not really sought after. People who do not look a certain way, people are made to feel like they're not adequate there. It's only people the kind of representation that is there on Bumble, we see like really able-bodied, very fit, ripped muscular torsos. That's all that's there on these profiles. And based on this, people talk to people. So we do not even go beyond the skin. It's skin deep. So I feel like it does not offer a safe space for people with disabilities. It's very quick. It's completely based on what a person looks like. And that's it. Now, on platforms like Bumble, where people talk about themselves and their disabilities, I haven't seen enough disabled people out there. I haven't seen enough people out there, basically. It's very, very, very few, especially in small towns like mine. I don't think I've seen any profile from my town. I believe the struggle are... So in the intersection of sexuality and disability, I would imagine that the struggle would be more. Because the current culture in the queer community, the current mainstream culture in the queer community is not very friendly. I'm talking about these sites like Grindr, which a lot of people use. I also know of a lot of people who are very empathetic and kind. But okay, I would say this is my experience. I wouldn't want to generalize anything, but I have not seen kindness from a lot of people. I have not seen, this is not me in any way judging the community for the way it is right now. But I somehow feel that sometimes it is really skin deep. I feel that so very often. So I can only imagine what kind of struggles people with disabilities would be going through.
How was your coming out process? Because I remember at 15 saying, fuck it, and just emailing my entire family at once.
That. So mine was really spread out long. So I think the first person I told was my best friend with whom I'd fallen in love, which is a classic gay story. It happens to everyone. And so he knew, but we were not in a position to really help each other because I was mad at him for not being in love with me and because he was straight. So that was complicated. And then I told a cousin of mine, and I used to call her. I didn't have a cell phone. I used to call her on the landline once every week and talk to her. So that gave me some release. Then there was an auntie I came out to. When I went to college, I found a few friends to come out to. So I always feel like college was where I was actually born, because that's where I started living as myself. I stopped pretending I was straight. it was no longer an insult to me to be called gay. That's where I really blossomed and bloomed. Then I started coming out, and my friends encouraged me to come out to people they trusted, people who were in my life. So I came out to my Korean teacher. I learned Korean when I was in college. He's the best. He's the closest person. I've not been this close to any teacher, and he means a lot to me. He's like my second dad. So I came out to him. That was a very major thing. I was literally shaking and shivering, and he asked me, "Are you about to cry? Like, what's wrong? What happened?" And it also happens that he's an ordained minister. He's a pastor. So I was really worried, but he comes from a progressive church and he accepted me completely for who I was. So that was a major shift for me from somebody who was religious. And then I sought my aunt's help. My auntie was my friend. She told my parents something. My mom understood that I was asexual, and that's when she told me it's okay to have a disability. I think she was happier knowing that I was asexual than homosexual, but then I told her I was homosexual, so now she's not happy, but she knows. And then, as you said, finally one day I was like, screw it. I've had enough of this. I don't even know who knows and who doesn't know anymore. So I called everyone. I did not email everyone. I actually called people one after the other. Everybody who I thought was important to my life. And I thought, okay, these people are important to me. These are the only people who are important to me. And I actually care about what they think. I really do care about what they think. So let them stay by my side or let them leave. It might be painful, but let's do this. So I called everyone and told them, hey, you actually mean a lot to me. Do you know that? And I told them, you have to know something about me. And I told them. And it mostly came out really well, even with people I thought was very religious. And with some people, it wasn't so great, but we're still in contact. They think that I'm under the devil's spell, but we still love each other in our own ways. And there were some people I could not really have a conversation with, but I messaged them. And then some of it went sour, but it's all good. So there was a time, it was basically a day or two when I broke out, I'd had enough. So I called everyone who mattered to me. This caused a lot of distress to my parents, because we live in a society where we don't tell anything to others. We don't show our dirty laundry. And I was like, this is not dirty laundry. This is part of who I am, and this is beautiful. So, yes. And even though my parents were unhappy, I had to do it. So now everybody who matters to me knows. And I don't know who else knows and who doesn't, and I don't care. If somebody asks me, I tell them exactly what it is.
Yes, exactly that. We were talking about the intersections between the two communities earlier. What do you think should be done to improve the intersection?
Since I moved in a lot of circles, I worked in the NGO sector for quite some time, and that's where I met so many activists, so many beautiful people from the disabled community. And I also met a lot of people from the queer community. I believe people should interact more, and I believe there must be more representation. The representation we have right now is not enough, and representation sadly has also become very political. But we ought to have more representation. There is a certain kind of fear that makes that somehow stops people from reaching out. There is a fear, like people who do not belong to the LGBTQ community have a fear of LGBTQ people. Not that they fear them, but they, well-meaning people, are afraid to reach out because they don't know how to behave, and they feel like they might cause anger or cause offense. And with the disabled community, it's also similar. People who are non-disabled often do not know how to approach disabled people. And within the queer community, it's not much different. The only thing I believe must definitely change in the queer community is I somehow feel that there is a very strange and insidious connection between lack of self-love, between hiding and between living a life that is meaningful. Because more often than not, when I used hookup apps like Grindr just to know people, just to get to know people, I saw that these people, most of them were not open about their sexuality. They wanted to keep things hidden, and they were only having these short sexual affairs that meant nothing to them beyond pleasure. There was nothing more meaningful to it. And it was skin deep, which is not very surprising considering the circumstances. Whereas people who have really gone through a lot of struggle and who have come out and who are really fighting for their rights, a lot of them are looking for meaningful relationships. I haven't studied this enough, but I feel like there is something to look into here. Now, when I believe being proud of yourself is something that is fundamentally necessary, whether we are disabled, whether we are queer, whether we are anything else in any way different from anybody else, we have to be proud of who we are. When we are not, and when we stick to the shadows, somehow so many things seem to go wrong. When we stick to the shadows, we only look for certain kinds of pleasure, quick things, quickies, and nothing long term, nothing that that they would want in the light as well. Within the queer community, I still do not have a community in my town where we all meet. It's only when I go to the neighboring city, Trivandrum, that's the only time I meet other people from the community. And I have not met enough people from the disabled community. I believe the queer community and the disabled community must come together, because we have all been crippled by culture. That's something we have in common. And I feel like we need more interaction, and we need to normalize things for all of us. And since both the queer community and the disabled community have a lot of people in the intersection, I think we really have a privilege in the sense that we have a bridge of people who are in that intersection who can really help others connect as well. And if we could do this, then we could expand it to include allies both of the queer community and of the disabled community, so that we can all understand each other and no longer fear to approach each other. I have very little exposure where I am. I talk to a lot of, since I'm open about my sexuality and my disability, I have a lot of young boys and girls calling me on the phone. Since I'm also a teacher and I have teacher friends, some of my colleagues call me and tell me that they have somebody struggling with their sexuality, a child or a teenager, and they would call me and talk to me. And that is when that's one of the ways in which I meet people and get to know a lot about struggles that people are facing, from young lesbian girls who are addicted to cough syrups, to young boys who are just looking for any kind of escape on hookup sites. I come across a lot of issues through social media and through online networking and through telephone networking. I hardly see anybody otherwise, because I live in a small town that does not give me that kind of scope. This has to change. We must meet more people, and people with disabilities, and people with, I firmly believe that people in the queer community and people in the disabled community, it would be worthwhile to arrange workshops or any events, book reading clubs. I'm happy to see literature coming up where people with disabilities, people who are disabled and queer are talking about their experiences, or characters who are both disabled and queer. So this is something that is slowly coming up in the queer community. We are getting queer characters who are disabled in books. And this is something we're slowly moving towards, but this progress is really, really slow in this. I live in the southernmost tip of India, literally. I live in the tip of the subcontinent, and here it's happening very slowly. And to speed up the process, I believe we must come together.
I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah.
The topic of mental health has been increasing through the years, which is so important for both intersections. What are you personally at? Where are you personally at in your mental health journey?
I am currently stable. I'm on medication. The medicines I take used to make me feel sleepy. And it used to cause a lot of anguish. And now it's better. I can stay awake for longer periods of time. But so when it comes to mental health, I'm in a good place. But when it comes to sexual health, I'm not so happy because my libido is really low. My sexual drive is not that good. And I know it's because of my medication. And there are, I know people in the community who stop taking their medication 3 days before a date just to have their libidos high. That's a very dangerous practice. It can have a highly debilitating effect on a person's mental health. So I'm not doing that. But I'm looking forward to, so I'm currently looking for different teaching positions. I finished my PhD recently, and I'm applying to colleges, and I'm mentally stable at this moment. I haven't had a depressive episode in years, and I'm good. But I know that this has come at a price, and I know that medication is useful. What I intend to do, though, is to take a risk and see if I can make do. Once I get a job, and once I know that I'm going to be staying in one particular place for at least 6 months, I'm going to take the risk of slowly weaning myself out of medication and making sure I do all the other things that keep me in a good place, because just medication is not enough. Journaling, taking a good walk in the morning or in the evening, talking to friends, keeping ourselves in a good place, and practicing mental hygiene every day. I hope to test the waters without medication, because sexual health is also very important to me. So I'm looking forward to doing that soon with my psychiatrist's continuous monitoring. Currently, I'm good. And I firmly believe I'll continue to do good one way or the other.
Was very good that you're feeling good right now. Earlier, you were talking about people contacting you, or people being a person of contact for other people when they have questions. That's also how you begin to understand what your calling is. When multiple people call or text or email you to come speak to a person or a group of people about the same thing over and over again, that's God revealing your purpose in life. And I thank you for undertaking that.
I believe that too. And it's a privilege.
That's okay. So you mentioned where you grew up earlier. How has being queer after growing up in a conservative environment like that affected you? Do you feel comfortable talking about that trauma?
Yeah, I can talk about it. There is no real way to hide. People often think that invisible disabilities and sexuality are really invisible. The thing is, they're not. when there is something within, there are ways in which it reveals itself. It may not be seen very easily, but it cannot be hidden. I tried my best to hide, and I could not. I know I was not successful in hiding because I was bullied in school for various reasons, and a lot of it pertaining to my sexuality. My childhood was not good. It could have been better. I'm grateful for everything, and I don't think I would change anything, but I don't think anybody else should really have to go through this. I also live in a place where we do not talk very openly. We don't have a culture of conversation and communication. We bottle things up, we shut things down. It's just not at all good for our mental health. But we're slowly trying to communicate. And so growing up, I think I'm a bit on the spotlight because I'm open about my sexuality and I'm not ashamed of it and I'm not sorry for it. I'm not apologetic about it at all. But again, as I said, people don't confront people. I hear that somebody said something about me. I heard from somebody else that he heard from another girl who goes to a church that I go to now and then, that I was no longer allowed in that church. And I didn't know that. And I didn't know if it was true. So I actually had to call somebody else and ask, have they actually forbidden me from entering that church? And she said, no, I haven't heard of anything like that. So this was a rumor. And when the rumor finally hits me, sometimes even I don't know if it's true or not. I have to go verify if it's true and then get back to the people. And I said, as far as I know, I haven't been forbidden from entering that church. And somebody had told somebody else that my father was really depressed because his son was gay, which hurt me. I'm very close to my father. And well, he may not be extremely happy because his son turned out to be gay, but he's not depressed either. He's sensible. He knows that there are different things in life and this is not that bad. People do not confront me. Very few people do. I have some ultra-religious aunties who have confronted me and who have warned me not to get into activism. They somehow pretend or whether they really don't know that I'm gay or whether they choose to look the other way, I don't know. But they know that I'm an activist. They know that I'm for this. And that's what they don't like. And they argued with me with the Bible. And when I argue back with them, they get really angry. I keep a distance from them because they're very religious people and there is no use in talking to them because they're not open to hearing my side of the story. They have already fixed me in a place that okay, Jebin is this kind of a person and this is what it is. So they are not open to anything from me. Beyond that, people don't talk straight to my face. They talk to other people and it's very demeaning sometimes, but I don't get to hear too much of it, thankfully. And whatever bad or whatever sadness I might experience overhearing such things is completely eclipsed by all the young people who call me and reach out to me and talk to me and ask me for help and advice. But one impact that I can definitely say is that my social circle in my town is very small. I have a very big network of friends. I have friends in many cities and I'm very close to them. So they come visit me, they stay with me for weeks sometimes and they go. But over here, I have 2 to 4 friends that I'm very close to. I only visit them. I don't visit anybody else. I don't talk to much people otherwise. I'm quite active in a choir, which is a Christian choir, and consequently I go to church and I happen to be quite active at church as well. But people do not confront me. I still hear a lot of other things. They don't affect me anymore. But being openly gay does affect our social life for most of us in this community. because people think of it a certain way. It is sadly related to sin and to eternal damnation. And one of the things I heard said about me was a well-meaning person, I think, telling her family that it was very sad that I was going to be denied a seat in heaven, which I don't believe at all. The problem is, if I did believe it, it would affect me. I get to know all these stories that circulate because these families have queer children. So this story was told to me by a young boy who's gay. And he told me that his family was having this conversation about me. So I can only imagine what kind of terrible burden he would be having on his mind. And if I can ease that a little bit, I'll be happy. And as much as my social circle is now smaller, it's also extremely tight. I know I can trust the people I have around me. So it in that way, I believe, even though my social circle has vastly diminished, because one thing I do not want to fraternize or get to know people, I know badmouth me behind me. I do not like that kind of energy. So I just kind of try to stay away from all of them. But it has really enriched my life because the few people who are in my life, I know I can trust them. And I have so many people in my contact list now who are not all close to me, but through social media, and they may be living in other towns, but we have, but we're really close because a lot of us are from small towns and a lot of us are from big cities, but with small town mentalities in their families. We have all been crippled by culture, and so we have that solidarity, and that has enriched my life.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you, let's go back for a moment. Earlier, you said you were hopeful that you'd be able to stop taking your medication. Do you have any fears about going down that road?
I do. I'm afraid I could go through a relapse. But it's a risk I'm willing to take. And either way, I believe I will be happy because this is something I want to try out. So it's something I'm doing more out of curiosity and rather than desperation, because I am happy with how I am. And I firmly believe in treating myself in the best way possible. And because of my... So because of my disability, and if I have to take medication, if I'm having a low sex drive, and if I'm okay with it, if I find a partner who's not okay with it, then it's a no-go. I have learned to treat myself well and to treat other people well, and I cannot accept anything less from anybody. Because if I allow myself to be treated badly, how can I treat anybody well?
That's strong. That's powerful there. Absolutely. What do you now know as a disabled queer person that you wished you knew sooner? And has your depression contributed to this?
I used to really overthink, and that somehow made things much worse. I used to question myself too much, be really harsh towards myself. I was a perfectionist. I was overcompensating, getting really good marks, focusing a lot on my studies. I was very proud of it as well. I was proud of it. I thought, okay, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not getting into drugs. I'm only studying harder and getting better things and doing better. I was trying to overcompensate. I was not happy with myself. I was secretly of the belief that I was not adequate. I was a bundle of nerves, and I overthought myself to death. I kept poking at wounds. I kept poking at past experiences where people would have treated me badly and where I treated people badly. I was bullied and I bullied in return. And so I was caught in a vicious circle of, oh, horrible things have happened to me, but then I deserved it because I did horrible things too. And so many things, guilt and depression and sexuality, I thought I was cursed. And I think I slowly learned that life is much more than all these things, that happiness does not come from outside. Even if I had everything, there is no assurance of happiness. There is no assurance of happiness if I was an able-bodied, ripped, and extremely attractive man in a very stable relationship with a man that I was in love with. There is no assurance of happiness. Happiness only comes from within. And every small thing, living life in the moment is not something that is overhyped. It's real. And to face and to be grateful for everything. Life can be so enjoyable when we learn how to embrace all these small, beautiful things, be it a small breeze or just a sunny day or beautiful clouds scuttling across the sky. I think one thing I wish I had known earlier was that not everything I heard or I was told was correct. That there is no one way to live life, that there is no one narrative where I should try to fit myself. I learned through literature from the African writer Ngugi Wa Thiong'o that knowledge must always, we go to knowledge, that knowledge should not be heaped on us from somebody else. So if I were to understand myself, I should not just listen to somebody else saying you're this or you're that. I must go and see it. If it is good, I take it. If it is not, I throw it. I do not take it and then question myself and think and think and think. I used to accept, I used to listen to people and just accept what they say, especially if they were adults, if they were pastors or teachers. Perhaps I could not have had that kind of critical thinking when I was that young. But I wish I had been kinder to myself and I had believed myself a little bit more, that I had validated my own experience against what I was told. And one thing I would tell myself is that it's okay. Whatever it is, it's okay. Everything becomes much better when I say this. I stop overthinking when I tell myself, okay, I'm going through something. I may have to get out of it. I may have to think of a solution. But first of all, let me tell myself, this is okay. And then once the mind clears, I can decide what step to take. I don't know if I could have gotten this maturity without having gone through what I went through. But I wish I had given myself more of an ear than religious texts such as the Bible. I kept trying to fit into that. I'm not trying to invalidate the Bible. I'm not trying to say if for somebody else it might help. For someone else it might work, a certain kind of religion or something. But I put religion, older people, and people I looked up to above myself. And I did not listen to the small voice in my head that was telling me the truth. Even when we are young, we know a lot. Knowledge is something that is not always taken from books or from other people. We have wisdom that is inherent to us. And I knew I was already on the right path and nothing was wrong about me. I wish I had not listened to other people who said something was wrong. We could do this with you. We could do that with you. Maybe we can pray. It will change. You'll get better. Nothing was wrong with me in the first place. I wish I had believed myself a little bit more. That's all.
Is it a religion or a faith and relationship with your God?
I'm not at all religious. Now I have a relationship with God, and it's not as simple as A plus B equals C, or the Bible says this, so it is this. It's much more complex than that. And I validate everyone's relationship with God, if they have a relationship with God or with the universe. So it is not a religion.
All right, thank you for that. I want to make it clear that depression is a common issue that's dealt with in both cultures, queer and disabled. When you think back to when you first started to work through your inner phobias, did you choose internalized homophobia or internalized ableism first?
I was dealing a lot with internalized homophobia. That was definitely first for me because I did not realize I was having depression. In fact, when I think about it now, the certain kind of melancholia that I used to get as a child, I have no idea how I survived that because I didn't even know what it was. I would feel horrible for vast stretches of time and then slowly get better. And I never told anyone, but I never really understood it as depression or anything of that kind. So once I was diagnosed, I did have internalized ableism, and I still worry that in interviews, if I told this, they would not hire me. So in religious places, I'm afraid they wouldn't hire me because I'm gay. In places with big ambitions where the company or the institution really wants to grow, I worry that they might see my disability as a liability. But for me, internally, I worked on my internalized ableism next. And it was as tough as... Except for the religious issue, because I did not think God was going to punish me for this. And thankfully, I did not think for too long. I did initially think it was punishment from God, but I did not believe that for too long because I was in college and I was reading a lot. I was talking to people. I had more access to wisdom of a certain kind that I did not have when I was younger. So I worked on my internalized ableism second. And however, even with all the resources that I had, it was still tough because it was unpredictable for me. And I was afraid of how I would be perceived. And then I understood that I was again putting the views of other people before my own. And I had to work on myself and become completely happy with who I was and accept every bit and piece of myself. And it was pretty similar to my internalized homophobia. And with self-love and with a lot of gratitude, practicing gratitude, I was able to heal myself from my internalized ableism.
That's wonderful. All right, we're coming up on the end now. Final question for you. Was there anything that you wanted to discuss today that we didn't touch on?
Well, one of the other things that I often discuss is violence. And violence plays a major role in the queer community here. Violence of multiple kinds. So as children growing up, we are physically bullied. Transgender children, gay children, lesbian children, we are physically violated. And that causes scars that are very difficult to heal. And I believe people with disabilities are also bullied. People with speech disabilities, people with multiple forms of disabilities, people with autism are bullied. I have friends with autism, and again, the violence is of different kinds. I see a boy, I believe he has autism. I see him practicing, I see him jogging around the ground, and I can see people laughing at him. And laughter in this moment is certainly violent. And I do my best to validate people when I see them, tell them a hello, smile at them, and make sure that spaces are safer for them. Safe spaces is something that we do not have here for the disabled people and for queer people. There are some spaces which are safe physically, but a lot of these spaces are not at all safe for the spirit of a person. Because when people laugh at one person who has decided to wake up at 5 in the morning and despite their disability to come jog in the ground, and when they run, sometimes their coordination is different, so they run in a haphazard way, whereas it's something that must be admired by everybody. Other people who come there, they smirk, and I believe this could really damage the spirit of the person. There is no spiritual safety there. And for a queer individual, the way they walk or the way they talk, people imitate them and make fun of them. And so I have been working with multiple forms of violence, manifest and latent. Even a prayer can be violent. When there was a book I read where a boy develops depression because his parents don't do anything to him. They don't beat him, but they keep praying loudly to God to heal him. And he can always hear them praying for his healing. And he actually becomes sick. He gets depression. So there are multiple forms of violence that the queer community and the disabled community we face. And I feel like safe spaces are not there enough. What is needed is empowerment. And I believe each and every one of us who has overcome some of the hurdles in life ought to really get back into the ground and really pick everyone else up who needs support now more than ever. Violence plays a very major, major role, sadly, in shaping our realities.
Oh, Jevin, thank you so much for bringing that up. It's been a great time. Thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation with me. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I did.
I certainly did.
I appreciate
it so much for the work that you do. It's for all of us. Thank you.
I appreciate the insights that you brought as well. If people want to connect with you and support the work that you do, how can they reach you?
I can share my email, my phone number, and my Instagram ID.
Awesome.
And my LinkedIn.
Awesome. We'll make sure that they get everything in the description below. Once again, I'm Sean Gold. Thank you for watching.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Make sure you like, comment all your thoughts, and subscribe. Also, make sure the bell is on to be notified of each upload. I'll see you next time on another episode of Crippled by Culture. See you, everybody.
Look forward. Thank you.
Want to listen to Crippled by Culture on your favorite podcast platform? Well, now you can. Crippled by Culture is now available wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search up the show title and make sure you subscribe. Thank you for being a listener.